You say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is the Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Folks, today is Thursday, October 4th. And in just 32 days, a small percentage of Americans will determine how every single American's life will change, for better or for worse, depending on your perspective. They can correct the disaster they couldn't possibly have intended, or they can stay the course, ride the wave. Some will vote their conscience, some will vote their own personal interests, some will vote to deprive others, some will vote to enrich others, some will vote to expand civil liberties, some will vote to restrict them. Some will vote out of ignorance. Some will vote carefully and thoughtfully. What's at stake? Everything's at stake. Are Americans diplomats who embrace the world as a single marketplace? Or are Americans exceptional and put themselves first without regard for others? Do Americans want the world to bake, to hell with their grandchildren? Or do Americans understand that the human species is at risk and we all need to sacrifice to save the planet for our heirs? Do we care if Jeff Bezos makes as much in 9 seconds as his median salaried worker earns in a year? This is WDIY, a member station of National Public Radio, and I'm your host of Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Alan Jennings. By day, night, and weekends, too, I'm the executive director of the Community Action Committee of the Lehigh Valley, fortunate enough to be given this opportunity once a month talk to WDIY's listeners, no doubt the smartest listeners in the Lehigh Valley, about what's going on in our world around us. A month ago, I had the privilege of hosting a congressional forum in this studio. Tonight, there are only three of us in the studio. Then there were about 33, I think. And we had a pretty good airing of the issues. We didn't have any petty bickering and personal attacks. It was straight up candidates talking about their views. And I thought they did a pretty good job. I want to tell you that I have great respect for people who run for office. Not all of them, but just about all of them, because I think the process is painful and it's excruciating. But hopefully we get good people that help make our world a better place. Today we're going to continue the discussion on the lead up to the election on November 6th. My guests, one is a familiar name, Chris Borick, Dr. Chris Borick, who's a political science professor at Muhlenberg College. Chris is a Penn State undergraduate and got his master's up the street from East Stroudsburg University. He's got his PhD from SUNY Binghamton. The only thing I knew about, I've ever been in Binghamton, was when I was at Dickinson College. I went there without tickets, hoping to get into a Grateful Dead concert. It was a 3.5-hour drive. I couldn't get into the damn show, and it was an enormous waste of my time. I won't hold you responsible for that, Chris, but welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alan.
Chris is the guy who you will read about whenever the morning call talks politics. There are a whole bunch of political science professors in Lehigh Valley, but for some reason, Chris has got a corner on that market. The other person I have with me tonight is actually on the phone with us, and that's Molly Reynolds. Molly you're going to be impressed, Chris, because her approach is different. She did her undergraduate at Smith College, uppity private liberal arts school, and she's got a PhD from the University of Michigan. So, Molly Reynolds, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Alan. It's good to be here.
Molly is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Let me just say a couple of things about, when I was 18 years old, I was at Dickinson College, having graduated from Emmaus High School in 1976, and I ran for school board at East Penn School District at the age of 18. And my plan was to be the youngest school board director in Pennsylvania,
And then run for state representative around 24 years old, be the youngest member of the Pennsylvania state legislature. And I was going to run for Congress when I was about 28, so I could be the youngest congressman in the country. Senate when I was in my mid-30s, and then I was going to finish my career as a wise man at a fellow at some uppity think tank. Well, Molly Reynolds is already a fellow at an uppity think tank. Molly is an expert on Congress and works at the Brookings Institution. She's in Washington now. And Molly's distinction, the real distinction, is that she used to walk about a block or so to school because she graduated from Liberty High School here in Bethlehem. Molly's brother is Bethlehem City Councilman Willie Reynolds. And so the other distinction that Molly has is that she was a student intern of mine. So I'm at the same time both jealous and proud of Molly Reynolds. Molly, what the heck does it mean to be a fellow at the Brookings Institution anyway?
It's a great job. It means that I get to think and write about politics, particularly Congress, and try to help people, you know, in the Lehigh Valley and all across the country, understand just what's happening here in Washington. Some days that's easier than others, but it's a real privilege that I get to use what I know to try and help people around the country understand what's happening in the world.
So my first question, Molly, is what do you know that the rest of us don't know?
I mean, there's a fair amount of very detailed knowledge about the U.S. Congress that I have. But just generally, I think an important thing to try and remind folks of right now in terms of what's happening in our politics is that there's some of what's been happening over the past 2 years and what will happen in the midterms coming up in November that is really a result of having elected Donald Trump president. There are certain things about how Congress has played out over the past 2 years, how the midterms are likely to go, that we can trace to Trump. But there's also plenty that's the culmination of a long period of purposeful decision-making here in Washington and elsewhere, especially by Republicans dating back to when Newt Gingrich became Speaker of the House in the mid-90s. And so, you know, I think it's easy and sometimes overwhelming to attribute what's been happening in the world just to Trump, but it's not all about the current president. Much of it is also about kind of a long period of history going back to the mid-90s.
When I read your background material, it sounded like you were an expert on Robert's Rules of Order, the sort of governance elements of being in the Congress.
It's certainly something I spend a lot of my time thinking about and trying to understand and trying to help other people understand, because it is, at the end of the day, the rules and procedures that Congress uses are really important for what they can and can't accomplish. But they're very confusing. They can be really complicated. And so it is one of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking and writing about.
Trying to think, Chris, if there's anything you and I know that she doesn't know.
Probably not much. I at least from my perspective. But I'll put that on you too, Alan. But could I just say, you know, Molly's perspective about institutions and structures having impact on outcomes in Congress is so real. As a political scientist, when I think about elections, I'm teaching an elections class over at Muhlenberg right now. Before we ever get to candidates, we talk about the systems, the cycles, the broader patterns that dictate lots of what happens in American politics and lots of the phenomena that we try to explain, like election outcome, who's going to win, isn't in the control of a campaign or its strategies. It's based on how we design districts. It's how the cycles are playing, how American voters behave over long patterns of time. So learning those structures, the systems, the rules, gives you a great insight into the outcomes that we're ultimately interested in.
You know, and so few Americans really have even the slightest, most vague knowledge or understanding of how the system works. I'm personally kind of a fan of the Congress. I think Congress is an interesting institution. Its history is fascinating. How it gets its stuff done, the fact that it gets anything done is pretty remarkable. But let's get straight to the point on this show, which is what's going to happen on November 6th?
Well, I'll take a first crack, and I'll go back to what I just discussed before about the power of cycles and the power of how Americans tend to behave historically in midterm elections. And that's not necessarily a deterministic factor that we know exactly what's going to happen, but the conditions are well set. You have midterm elections, which are punitive to the president's party almost always. Only twice since World War II has that not happened. That was in 2002 after the 9/11 attacks and during the 1998 race with Bill Clinton during the midst of the impeachment hearings. Those two are the outliers. Every other time, the president's party has lost. And quite often, fairly significantly, we've seen those elections over and over, the so-called wave elections in American politics, where presidents standing after coming into office, if it is not very good, and that's where Donald Trump's standing is by almost any empirical measures that we see out there right now, president's party pays a price. And so for a lot of districts across the country right now, especially those with open seats, those that might have been affected by measures such as the redistricting in Pennsylvania, it's a challenging environment for Republicans.
Molly Reynolds.
No, and I agree with everything that Chris just said, and I'll add that when we think about the Senate in particular this fall, it's worth remembering that the Democrats are defending many more seats than the Republicans are, and that is, as Chris pointed out, a feature of the cycles that Senate seats go through. So one-third of the U.S. Senate is up for re-election every 2 years, and the current set of senators who are up for re-election now in 2018 were last on the ballot in 2012, when a number of the Democrats in particular were aided by President Obama's re-election in 2012. So there are a number of vulnerable Democratic members of Congress, of the Senate, who I think if Hillary Clinton had won the presidential election in 2016, they would be in much more electoral danger than they are this year. There are 10 Democratic senators who are running for re-election this year in states won by President Trump in 2016. And so those are seats that are often difficult for Democrats to defend. But as Chris points out, midterm elections like the one that we're in right now are historically quite bad for the party of the president. And so those sort of two forces are feeding off against each other as we approach the November election.
Now the Senate, they're now saying, is competitive and it could well go to the Democrats. My understanding is that Claire McCaskill, who is the senator in Missouri, and John Tester in Montana, both are being on the verge of moving from the vulnerable column to the safe column. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, so it's difficult to know, obviously, exactly what's going to happen. But like I said, there are a number of these sort of red state Democratic senators who are being aided by the national political conditions, by how unpopular President Trump is, and also by their ability to hold their own against particular challengers, and I would put both Tester and McCaskill in that group. I'd also include Joe Manchin, who's running for re-election in West Virginia. And then, if Democrats are to retake the Senate, they have to, you know, hold the seats that they currently have, and they would need to pick up some seats. The two best pickup opportunities for Democrats are in Nevada, where Dean Heller is running for re-election, but has to answer for a number of policy positions he's taken over the past 18 months, including support for repealing Obamacare. And then in Arizona, where there's an open Senate seat because Senator Jeff Flake is retiring.
So what would you say the likely outcome is going to be in November?
So I think the most likely outcome is that Democrats take control of the House, but Republicans hold control of the Senate. I'm not saying that's definitely what's going to happen. I definitely got out of the prediction business after the 2016 election. But I think if you look at a combination of the polls, both in specific races, as well as what we call the generic ballot, where voters around the country are just asked to report, you know, which party would you prefer controls Congress, a combination of those, and the kind of national political forces, how unpopular President Trump is. I think that the possibility of Democrats retaking control of the House are pretty good, but they really do face an uphill battle in the Senate thanks to the particular map that they're facing this fall.
Do you expect any kind of tectonic shift this time? I mean, the kind of thing that's like momentous.
I think that there's a possibility for quite large Democratic gains in the House. I don't think that's a terribly likely outcome. I think that, you know, we'll see Democrats pick up enough seats to take the majority, but not necessarily, say, a 50-seat pickup or anything like that. Not necessarily a wave on that level, but I do think that Democrats will gain enough seats to take control of the House.
You know, when I watch the news, I sort of look at it kind of through my fingers, you know, like I don't want to look, but I can't help but look, you know, kind of like Joseph Conrad's old fascination with the abomination. And almost every day, something crazy happens that I think could shift massive numbers of voters. So, I mean, we've got a president who over the next, 32 days, could pull off 10 or 12 crazy enough things to make it shift back and forth, don't you think?
I'll jump in on that one. Yeah, sure. The events of the day in any cycle could have moderate effects, Alan, that's for certain. And if there's a major change or some kind of event that takes place that is historic in the next month, well, all bets are off, right? The historic nature of those two elections I talked about, 1998 and 2002, were historic in that there was just oddities happening there with the impeachment and the post 9/11 world that we were inhabiting. But those daily things that you talk about, the kind of the big event that might happen, like last week, the Kavanaugh hearings, certainly those things are bringing our attention in, and they're important in the big mix and might have marginal effects on who turns out and doesn't turn out. But a lot of it's baked in the cake. It's baked in the sense that a lot of people, how many, for example, last week, how many people's minds did the Kavanaugh hearings change?
Well, I want to talk about that in some depth in a few minutes, but Kavanaugh is just one example.
Sure.
How about the president standing up and acting like a 14-year-old bully and saying how we're going to dominate the world and the audience literally laughing out loud at him collectively?
I mean, I think it's important to remember that a lot of the sort of things that we see in the news that, you know, people who are paying attention at the level required to follow every twist and turn, every, you know, thing Trump said or that thing Trump tweeted about, those are folks who are already paying a lot of attention to politics. And so to the extent that any particular news event is going to kind of shift their perceptions, you know, people go and pay attention to politics because they're interested in it. And I think that oftentimes we overestimate the degree to which any one event is going to change people's minds, given the level of interest that's required to be paying that much attention to kind of the ins and outs of the daily news cycle.
You're listening to WDIY. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. WDIY, of course, is our NPR member station in Lehigh Valley. Neil Heaver's here making all the mechanical things work. Chris Bork is with me. Chris Bork is the political science professor at Muhlenberg College, who tells us what people think in the Lehigh Valley as the pollster for Muhlenberg College. And I also have Liberty High School class of what, like 1992 or something, Molly?
2002 is when I graduated.
2002, isn't that awful, man?
A whole decade.
Oh, my gosh. Anyhow, Molly Reynolds is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. I'm jealous as heck of her. Molly, thanks for being on the show. Christopher, thanks for being here. We're going to take a quick break. Your listeners know that this is a very quick break. Don't go far. Stick around.
The Many Choices and Real Voices on WDIY are made possible with support from our generous, sustaining members. An automatic monthly gift of $10 on your credit card is an easy way to become a WDIY member and support the programs you love. Set up your monthly sustaining membership gift today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 7 or visit wdiy.org. Thank you.
Glad you're back. This is Alan Jennings. This is WDIY, Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, and my guests tonight are Molly Reynolds, a fellow from the Brookings Institution, and Chris Bork, a well-known political science professor here in the Lehigh Valley. Molly, when I think of Brookings, I get the image of Rodin's The Thinker in my mind's eye. You know, when you chart the workings of our government, where does all of this lead in terms of Congress as a living, breathing, organic body? I mean, does it work anymore?
It does, and it doesn't. There are certainly things where Congress and areas where Congress functions much less well than it once did. But at the same time, you do still see members of Congress finding ways to come together and solve certain governing challenges. You know, for example, in recent weeks, Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate have figured out a way to fund large parts of the government for the fiscal year that begins today. You know, we didn't have a whole debate about whether or not we were going to have a government shutdown. That's become a staple of every September, this question of can Congress get its act together and get some spending bills across the line. So there are certainly things that mean that Congress doesn't work well. We live in a time of very high polarization where the degree to which Democrats and Republicans agree with each other on policy questions, their parties are quite far apart. We also live in a time of very high electoral competition. So each party, you know, looks at the next election and says, hey, it's possible that my party is going to be in control after the next election. So I really don't have an incentive to cooperate with folks on the other side of the aisle. And so those kind of structural forces make it hard for Congress to get things done, but we do sometimes see them and individual members find a way to buck those trends and get things across the finish line.
You know, from my perspective, Charlie Dent, who, you know, I've known Charlie for many years, and I like Charlie a lot. His politics are a little bit different from mine. But I thought of him as practically a rock star in Congress over the last couple of years. He was one of the few Republicans who really had the nerve to, you know, point out that the emperor has no clothes. Was he seen as a kind of a rock star type of person nationally, like I sort of perceived of him from my, you know, from my perch?
Yeah, I think that now former Congressman Dent is sort of perceived in Washington as the last of an old guard of kind of pragmatic Republicans. So we've seen over the past decade or so the real kind of elimination of many Republicans from the northeastern part of the United States. So, you know, there are, I believe, no longer any Republican members of Congress from New England, and, you know, there are fewer from other parts of the eastern seaboard. And so Dent was really a last of the old guard in that way. And part of that, I think, reflects the, you know, the particular electoral situation that he faced in the Lehigh Valley. So, you know, he represented a district that had both Republicans and Democrats. And to keep winning re-election, he had to find a way to appeal to that voter base.
Chris, would Charlie have won handily?
Yes. Yeah, he would. I mean, we've done polling a lot over Charlie's career. In Lehigh County, for example, the heart of his base, if you will, in the old 15th district, he'd get 30% Democrat vote in our exit polls. I mean, that's exceptional, right?
Yeah.
He was able to really have a broad reach that fit the district well. His problem all along, and I'm, you know, only Congressman Dent or former Congressman Dent could tell you why he stepped aside this cycle and some other opportunities. But the primary election really posed the greatest difficulty for him, especially in the old 15th district. Remember, he resigned before or said last fall that he was going to step aside before the redistricting happened. And that left him in that old district, a more conservative district, a real challenge in the primary if he was to be challenged. I don't know if he wanted to go through that one more time.
Was Barletta's old congressional district, which was at least as ugly in its gerrymandering as Dent's, was that thrown out to when Charlie's congressional district was redistricted?
Yeah, they were all, you know, there's all the moving parts of the redistricting. So the far western edge of the old 15th, which stretched down to Hershey,
yeah.
That when that was brought east, if you will. The district now ends at the Lehigh County Berks line, and the district became the Lehigh Valley District. It allowed what was Congressman Barletta's old 11th district to now the new district to come down south into Schuylkill County and down towards Berks County. And what happened, it pushed in all the moving parts of this as the Lehigh Valley became centered again around one district with a strip of the southern Monroe County where the Poconos are. That's the new 7th district. All those voters, the people that used to be in the 17th, that's the Cartwright district up in Scranton, places like Easton and Nazareth, that part of the district now belongs in the new 7th, and the Cartwright's district actually has become modestly more conservative because those voters were taken out of it. So a lot of moving parts.
You know, I'm a political science major too, for what that's worth. I went to a little school called Dickinson College, you know, there's this notion of the political pendulum. You know, that it kind of swings back and forth, and the idea always was that it was equidistant. You know, it kind of swung back and forth. But when I look back, you know, Johnson was a pretty rock-solid liberal. Nixon moved it back to the right. In comes Carter, moves it back to the left, but not as far back as Johnson was, right? Carter's replaced by Ronald Reagan, who moves it further right than Nixon was. Clinton comes in and moves it back to the left, but not as far left as Carter was. George W. comes in, moves it back to the right, further right than Reagan was. Obama comes in, moves him back to the left, but not as far left as Clinton had. And now we've got this guy who's off the charts. So what's going on out there in people's minds politically? Are we getting more conservative as a country? Or is one party better at turning people out and convincing their voters not to vote in their own best interest? What's going on that we seem to get more and more conservative, even though when you run polls and ask people questions about their positions, they tend to be moderate to liberal on a lot of the actual issues. So what the heck is going on here?
So one thing that we've seen certainly in Congress over the past couple of decades is that as the parties have moved farther apart, and you know, we no longer see that many conservative Democrats or that many more liberal Republicans. Those folks have kind of disappeared from the political center in Congress. But as we've seen the parties move farther apart, we've seen the Republicans move further to the right than the Democrats have. So that's certainly part of what is happening. And as I was saying before, it's also the degree to which both parties now in Congress, again, look at the next election and see a real possibility that they could be the majority party, which just takes away some of the incentive to compromise. There's really very little incentive to work with your colleagues across the aisle if you think that come the next election, your party might be in power, that partisan control might switch.
So by historical standards, is the Congress really that bad?
So we've certainly seen periods of the kind of intense partisan competition that we're living in now before. The one that we're living in right now is pretty long by historical standards. It goes back to the early 80s, this idea that after the next election, either party could be in control. We do have, again, particularly high levels of polarization, so the parties in Congress are quite far apart. And these two kind of structural features of the political system also are interacting with more and more complex policy problems now that Congress has to solve. So, you know, Chris has done a lot of work on climate change. That's among the sort of really tricky policy problems, the ones that are more complex now than some of the things that Congress used to tackle. You know, if you think about the kind of technological knowledge that Congress needs to have to make informed decisions on, say, government surveillance now than in a world where we only had landline telephones, you know, there's a degree to which it's harder for Congress to figure out how to do the work now, and that interacts with these big partisan dynamics that just together have made it difficult for Congress to get a lot of things done.
You're listening to the WDIY. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. I have two political geniuses in the on the show with me tonight. One is Molly Reynolds, a fellow at the Brookings Institution. The other is Chris Borick, who is Muhlenberg College professor and the grand pollster poobah of the Lehigh Valley. So let's get into some poll-related issues. How do you do your job anymore, Chris? I cell phones, caller ID, cynical people who think the whole system is corrupt, you know, blah blah blah. I mean, we don't even have a landline anymore. And when we did have a landline, we only used it to screen out all the constant phone calls. I didn't think I was getting any polling calls though, because I'd take those calls because I want to influence them. So the question is, I mean, how do you know? How do you have any sense that your sample can even be a legitimate sample by today's rules?
No, it's a great question, and it's an incredibly dynamic and changing polling environment. When I started polling in the Lehigh Valley, I'd done some work in Wisconsin before this, but when we came here in 2001, when the Institute was formed, we did nothing but landlines, right? Our first polls were completely landline. That made it pretty easy, right? You know, your
probably didn't think about the time, but looking back.
Oh, it really was. Yeah. Our completion rates, the number of calls we had to make, everything was much easier. And the methodology was easier. So we've had to adapt over time, just like our whole industry has. And you try to find the best practices and you adopt to changing technologies. For example, in our surveys that we do, election and non-election, like our climate change polls nationally, we could have upwards of 85% of our calls are done on cell phones right now over time. Now, it's a little bit less in local election polls, like when we're polling the 7th, because a lot of the voters are still older, disproportionately have access to landlines compared to the general population. So we have to adjust all the time our calibration of those aspects. We've really turned over time. When I started doing polling in the Lehigh Valley and statewide back in 2001, we used landlines. We used RDD. Basically, we took the universe of all possible phone numbers in the state landlines and called. We transitioned about 7-8 years ago to voter files. Campaigns had always used voter files, but we had some methodological concern about limiting potential voters who weren't registered at any time. But for access sake, we've turned over to those voter files, which gives us a lot more information about voters. For example, how do you determine a likely voter in a mid-year election when only 35% or so might show up at the polls? So
35% of eligible voters.
Of eligible voters, yeah.
Not registered. I mean, not all voters.
Not the voting age population, right, of eligible voters. And so we have to do a lot of screening. We have to make decisions, right? And we have to do a lot of things that bring in challenges, like figuring out if a new voter came in right now and they registered, do we consider them likely, or are they just registering for some other factor? So it's a complex measure. Here's the one thing I would say. Much to as of course the presidential election in 2016 caused a lot of consternation about the polls, and there's some fair critiques of those. But on the whole, and this some people don't want to agree to this, the polls were about just about as accurate as they've always been. You know, the national poll said Hillary Clinton would win by 3 points; she won by about 2. Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, there were more struggles there. But the polls as a whole, if you look at them in terms of validating the predictions versus the results, are not as bad as people think. But sometimes people put way too much precision on what they see. If it's a 2-point lead for one candidate and you say, oh, well, it looks like they're in great shape, it's 2 points. There's a lot of variability and noise and margin of error and other things that people have to build into their appraisals. And we don't do as good a job sometimes in the media and in the industry of really making the limitations as known as they should be to the public.
Do you ever poll non-voters? I mean, specifically about politics, about government issues and so on.
We don't do... So we haven't done a non-voter poll, if you will. We could. We can go out and say, hey, we just want to talk to people that don't vote.
Why are you not voting? Why are you not participating? Don't you care about the air you breathe and how much money you get paid and whether you have health benefits?
I mean, sure. There's a lot. A lot of studies have been done over time on why people don't vote. And the political psychology of it is really incredible, how we come up to our decisions and what factors we use in voting. But, yeah, non-voters are a key group to look at. Unfortunately, during election time, all attention is paid to the voters, right? So right now, we're interested in who's most likely to show up in early November and make an appraisal of not only how they intend to vote, but the underlying factors. Those are my favorite parts of the polls. Why are people making decisions? What role does the president play? What issues are most salient? Those type of factors tell the story of any cycle.
Molly, when it comes to your work at the congressional level, you're looking at national polls generally, are you not? Are you?
So it's a combination because at the end of the day, House and Senate majorities are built. The building blocks of those victories come in individual races around the country, and so, you know, I look at a combination of national polling again on things like the generic ballot, where voters are asked generally which party would they prefer to see control Congress, at presidential approval nationally. Both of those pieces of information historically have helped us understand what's likely to happen in the midterm election. But at the end of the day, you know, if Democrats retake control of the House or if Republicans maintain control of the House, it's going to be because of how particular races around the country turn out. So it's a mixture of both levels of information that I kind of need to understand in order to guess or make predictions about what's going to happen in a given election.
You know, one of the things that, you know, offends people and chases them away is that they are kind of tired of watching the, you know, nothing getting accomplished, both sides warring with each other. And I always hear people say both sides are to blame. But I look back at, you know, George W. Bush running. He got Democratic votes to pass No Child Left Behind. He got Democratic votes to pass a massive tax cut. He got Democratic votes to go into Iraq. Obama gets elected, and Mitch McConnell states unequivocally, we will not give him a single win in the Congress. Why is it that people, I don't want to be partisan here, but, you know, that observation would suggest one side is more guilty than the other. Are you able to determine that, Molly? Is that a fair thing that for anybody to take a, because Brookings is supposed to be a nonpartisan institution, right?
Yes, we are. We are vigorously nonpartisan.
So,
To speak to your question, I'll say a couple of things. One, as I mentioned earlier, when we look at kind of how members of Congress have voted over time in the chamber, we do have pretty good evidence that Republicans have moved farther to the right over time than Democrats have moved to the left. And so that's part of, I think, what you're seeing. I think also there's some kind of structural differences between the two parties that have helped drive this. So I think the Republican Party, and there's some political science research that suggests this, the Republican Party has historically and even in the current period tends to be kind of more ideological and reward commitment to a set of particular ideological principles, whereas the Democratic Party is much more a collection of different kinds of social groups that are trying to get things through and from the government. And that kind of difference between the two parties means that, you know, Republican voters are, I think, more likely to reward commitment to what they see as the principles of the Republican Party than Democrats are. And that also helps feed this behavior in Congress and helps explain why things like, you know, Senator McConnell at the beginning of the Obama administration was so vocal about saying, you know, they weren't going to work with Democrats to get very much done.
Interesting. You're listening to WDIY, listener-supported public radio. I'm your host on Lehigh Valley Discourse, Alan Jennings. With me tonight are my guests, Chris Borick from Muhlenberg College and Molly Reynolds from the Brookings Institution, as well as Liberty High School, by the way. Stick with us. We're going to take another short break, and we've got another segment coming with Chris Borick and Molly Reynolds.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or wdiy.org.
Welcome back. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. 1982, Peter Kossmeyer loses his reelection campaign in Bucks County. Great guy. I liked him a lot. Peter Kossmeyer, Don Ritter was our congressman at the time, very, very conservative congressman. I used to haunt the guy. I'd follow him around to town meetings and pick on him. Peter Kossmeyer said to me, Alan, the most important thing about getting elected is not how much money you can raise or even your position on the issues. It is whether or not people can like you. Well, what about Donald Trump? I mean, my impression is that nobody likes this guy. When I talk to Republicans, I'll say to them, what are you doing? How can so many Republicans support this guy? And they'll tell me, you know, I can't stand him, but I like his policies. What's up with that? Is it really, I mean, is Kossmeyer right? Or I mean, what's going on there?
Likeability is a huge factor. It is. And as you said, lots of people don't like Donald Trump for an array of reasons, personality reasons, policy positions, action reasons, but a lot do for a whole set of things. We talk about this in class, the heuristic. It's a psychological term, right? You use shortcuts to do your evaluations of things and people, right? And so you might have shortcuts for why you would like Donald Trump. You just like the way he sounds and looks and talks and his approach to things that cuts above almost all the other content that others might appraise use in their appraisals. We do a lot of that shortcutting. And so people do like Donald Trump, not according to the polls. And as we look at it, more dislike him. His favorability ratings aren't very high historically. He's underwater in terms of his favorable to unfavorables, but there are certainly characteristics that a lot of people turn to as they make their evaluations that aren't often very deep, but those cognitive shortcuts that they take lead them to very much say they like the guy.
Oh, man. take a deep breath on this. I mean, my impression, when Ronald Reagan was president, his positions routinely defied what the polls were saying. The polls would say, you know, people are pro-choice. People don't think we should make people go hungry. People think public education is worthy of being funded. And then they'd vote for Ronald Reagan. And it was the same thing with George W. Bush. And you know, my impression is that people appreciate the resolve of a politician. And somebody feels like they're a principled person. They're standing by their position. Even if they disagree with it, they think that's an important part of a leader. And I mean, that's what seems to be in play to me, because and so many people I know can't even watch or listen anymore. Molly, what do you think?
So, I mean, I think it's worth remembering that for a lot of kind of specific issues, we see people's attitudes flow from their partisanship and not the other way around. So there are a lot of, particularly for people who don't necessarily pay lots and lots of attention to politics, they are more likely to kind of take cues from what the leaders of the party that they identify with are saying, and then say, you know, oh, I agree with that perspective. And so I think that a lot of times when we see voters, you know, saying that they want things and the Congress going in a different way, some of that has to do with the fact that voters at the end of the day are really motivated by kind of their partisanship and their party identification and less by their feelings on specific issues.
And can I just add, that's a great point by Molly, but even independents, you know, we're talking about independents in class the last few weeks, and independents aren't really independent, right? There's a bad name and brand with being partisan these days, especially among younger voters. Mm-hmm. So they won't tell you that I'm a Democrat or Republican. They might not even register that way, even when the incentives are to register in a closed primary state like Pennsylvania. But they vote in partisan ways, right? They vote partisan. Independents almost always vote overwhelmingly for one side, right? They don't go back and forth. They're not purely independent of party. And so the types of factors, you know, that the pull of party, even if we don't admit it, even if we don't say we're part of a party or we say we dislike it, the pull of party is very big. It's those cues that come from party leaders and our allegiance to parties that shape so much of our political behavior.
So we've got all these alienated people who could be voters who choose not to vote, or choose not to even register for many, and many that register don't vote. Who benefits from the alienation of voters? Which, I mean, Democrats or Republicans do, don't they?
Yeah, I think if you look at who the non-voters are demographically, they tend to be younger, more likely to be racial minorities, often in urban areas, also some rural pockets. If you affix, Alan, if you affix the to that group the behaviors of similar folks that are engaged, they tend to be much more democratic. They tend to be much more liberal and progressive in their politics. And therefore, you would assume if that group was brought into the electorate, it would probably shape our politics in a left-leaning direction.
I think this midterm in particular stands to potentially teach us some lessons about this. Because historically, Republicans have had an advantage in midterm elections because the kinds of voters who are more likely to habitually turn out to vote are also the kinds of voters who are more likely to vote Republican. So they tend to be older, they tend to be whiter, they tend to be better educated. And so that has contributed often to Democratic disadvantages in midterm elections. And so there's very high levels of Democratic enthusiasm going into among Democratic voters, among people who say they intend to vote for Democratic candidates going into the midterm elections in November. And so I think it'll be worth watching whether we see any kind of different behavior than what we've seen in the recent past on this dimension.
You know, I kind of get the impression, I don't want to make any broad, you know, characterizations that sound like I'm stereotyping or partisan for that matter, but I think there are a lot of people in elective office who oppose government, and they want to do all they can to show government doesn't work so that they can reinforce the position that government doesn't work. And people who, you know, want to, you know, elect that kind of person know who that is. You know, I mean, it just seems to me that there's a self-fulfilling prophecy there. Let's make sure government can't work, and therefore people will vote against government, and, you know, a certain group is going to be happy. The meanness of politics these days, including, you know, what some call trolls, people who you just picture sitting in their pajamas at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in their parents' basement, you know, on their laptop, just writing ugly comments on newspaper articles and blogs and stuff like that. What is fueling that? Why are we getting so ugly as a people in terms of how we relate to each other and how we view our government?
You know, I think Molly talks about the 90s as being fairly key in turning some of this. And I think some of the politics of that era had started a long-term train that's taken us down. But I would go where you went a bit on the technology. This is a complicated question to both measure and to explain, but the arrival of the internet, and more particularly cell phones and social media in the last 15 years, I think has really elevated the ability of individuals to speak in ways they never spoke before.
Yeah.
You know this, Alan. I mean, someone that's moderately in the public eye that in my life. You know, people, when I'm face-to-face talking with folks, people are almost universally nice. You know, some people come up and say they disagree with me. And
I call it the grocery store phenomenon.
The grocery store, always. You know, and I rarely come in those situations, but, you know, post a poll that somebody doesn't like, and I'm the worst human being in the world, right? I'm partisan.
They call you nice things like human beings?
Yeah, that's true. I guess that would be much. But sure, and if you're publicly commenting on things, you're going to get feedback all the time. That's in those forms, especially in the anonymous world of social media, where you could be anonymous, it's elevated.
And then you combine that with the decline of the mainstream press, and I, for example, I'm not sure how successful I would be at the work that I do if it wasn't for the press and my ability to use what you call reputational risk, you know, the threat of looking bad in the news media. Well, what is the news media these days? It's like this anarchistic world of craziness that I don't think anybody understands anymore, and nobody really dominates at all. Molly, is that affecting how people campaign for Congress?
Yes, I mean, I think one big consequence of technological change in terms of congressional campaigns is to think about the possibility of the viral moment, if you will, and the degree to which even small things that get captured at one rally or one speech can all of a sudden become national news in a way that was less true when, you know, we didn't all have cell phones that could record video wherever we went. So I think back to, and in some ways this seems like a little bit of a quaint incident given where some of the rhetoric has gone, but if you think back to, I believe it was 2006 when George Allen, who was running for Senate in Virginia, mm-hmm. was captured on video using a racially derogatory term directed at a young man who was tracking him for the rival Democratic campaign. And then all of a sudden that reshaped the race, this one sort of throwaway remark that had been caught on video. And so I think that people, the kind of the change in technology and the rise of things like Twitter and Facebook have made campaigns, I think, more sensitive to the prospect that any one thing that happens could have an effect on the race.
So let's talk about one thing that happened, Kavanaugh. How does that affect the election?
So it's really hard to know, and I'll go back to something I said earlier about the level of engagement that someone who's been following the ins and outs of the Kavanaugh nomination fight has to have in order to be consuming that much information about politics. And those kinds of people, I think, generally have their partisan preferences baked in already. You know, the kind of person who sits down and watches the Kavanaugh hearings, any of them, again, tends to be pretty engaged in politics. We know already that Democratic enthusiasm going into the midterms is quite high, so it's not clear that whatever has been happening with Kavanaugh is going to increase that much more. And on the Republican side, you know, there are, and historically Republican voters have cared more about court nominations than Democratic voters have. But I think, again, many people who have felt the degree to which they say they feel mobilized by what's been happening with Kavanaugh were probably inclined to vote anyway. And so I don't know. I think it obviously has real impacts on potential legitimacy of the Supreme Court and whether Americans see the Supreme Court as a legitimate institution, which is really important for a branch of our government for whom basically all of their power comes from their legitimacy in the public eye. But in terms of the election, I just don't see a huge impact of what's been happening.
Chris, you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. The group that I think if Kavanaugh's nomination was to collapse and he's pulled or doesn't get confirmed, I do wonder about its depressing effect on Republican turnout. I think that's why I think Republicans are so committed to the candidate per se. They'll get someone on most likely in the near future that is ideologically similar to Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. But with the midterm election coming, if for some reason this looked like it folded or failed, it might have a modest depressing a vote on Republican turnout. And Republicans can never afford that. There's fewer Republicans. Their secret recipe, if you will, is turning out. And I wouldn't collapse turnout, but I'm sure it could have, I'm suspecting it have a modest depressing effect.
I have enough time to ask, I think, one more question. So let me make it this. What do you think are the two or three key issues that are going to affect this election? I mean, what are the two or three? I mean, I think President Trump is the issue. After Trump, where do you go? What is the issue that's going to be the real driver of who wins this election?
You know, in my perspective, beyond Trump, who I think is defining the midterms in many ways, look at issues like healthcare. I think healthcare is stealthily important, and the concern about what happens next with healthcare, what the vote might mean in terms of where we go in the next stage. It's kind of drifted off the radar and the discussion and the discourse. But I don't think, at least in some of our polling that we've done in Pennsylvania recently on a statewide level, it remains in the top tier of issues for a number of voters. And I think, you know, as people think about their healthcare situation, that could have a sneaky impact on this race.
Yeah, I completely agree with Chris on this point. I think if you look at data on what Democratic congressional and Senate candidates are talking about across the country, they're not talking about Trump nearly as much as they're talking about health care. And they're not running campaigns, by and large, that are about, you know, if you elect a Democratic majority, we'll impeach President Trump. No, they're talking about these are Republicans who voted last year in the House to take away the protections for pre-existing conditions, take away health care that, you know, you have access to thanks to the Affordable Care Act. And so I think it's been fascinating to watch Democrats sort of run towards Obamacare when many of them spent many years running away from it. But I do think that that is a really big issue that's going to shape what happens in the midterms. And I think we see candidates talking about it to that effect.
Given Florence wreaking havoc in South Carolina, massive storm in size, why is climate change not getting traction? That's the one that just makes me, I think, craziest.
You want to do a whole show on that sometime,
well,
Al?
We will.
I've got 10 years of data for it. Salience is so important, right? You're right. We're seeing more and more individuals connected to their daily lives. It hasn't gotten to a point where I think it is on our daily list. When Pew, for example, polls this, it still shows up about 18 out of 19 issues. It's relatively low. It's changing, though. It is changing.
All right, let's do a quick sizing up of the races, and I don't know if either of you can answer these. Who wins Wild Nullstein Silphies?
You know, all things being equal. I mean, it's in no incumbents, more competitive district. Let's go to cycle. So I think cycle advantage is Wild.
I'd agree with that. I think that given what we know about the national conditions that are shaping the midterm and then what we know about the demographics of the district, particularly post the redrawing of the lines for this election, I think that she probably has the advantage, but it will be quite competitive.
Matt Cartwright's seat, is he vulnerable?
More so than he was, again, offsetting against cycle. I'm sounding like a recording. The district is more difficult for him, taking out some of the Democratic parts of the Lehigh County. I think he's pretty safe. You saw voters, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre area, which is still the heart of that area, particular Scranton, other than the presidential race, voted down ballot for Democrats in 2016 overwhelmingly for the state row offices and Cartwright. I think he's safe.
Casey Barletta, who wins?
I think that that race is pretty favorable for Casey. You know, Casey, I think, represents the interests of a pretty broad swath of Pennsylvanians and has done a good job reflecting those preferences in the Senate. And I think that to the extent that we see high Democratic enthusiasm going into the midterms, particularly among, I think, white suburban women in places like suburban Philadelphia and suburban Pittsburgh and parts of the Lehigh Valley, I think those will help Casey.
In a word, Chris, you agree?
Yeah. Barletta, in one word, if Trump's numbers don't rise dramatically, Lou Barletta can't. They're tied together. They're tethered together.
Well, you've heard it from the experts tonight. That's Chris Borick from Muhlenberg College and Molly Reynolds from Liberty High School, who happens to be a Brookings Fellow. Thanks to both of you for being on the show.
Thank you.
You know, folks, it doesn't have to be this way. You can vote. It's a neat thing about democracy. Everybody gets a voice. So get up, stand up, and speak out and make the world a better place. You know how to do it. That's it for Lehigh Valley Discourse this time. I'm Alan Jennings, your host. Thank you very much.